Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up today. First, in a little while, we'll speak with Robert Scott, who is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, on whether China is an unfair trade and currency manipulator. The U.S. Treasury was supposed to issue a report on April 15th, and it's postponed that, whether China is playing with its currency value in order to stimulate its exports. Robert Scott thinks they definitely are at the cost of many, many, many jobs in the United States, and we'll talk to him about why he thinks that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Matt Taibbi, who is a Rolling Stone journalist and author of quite a few really fine pieces on the Wall Street scandals over the last couple of years. We'll talk to him about how Wall Street Sharpies have been running around ripping off small towns around the world and small countries, too, and the U.S. taxpayer while they're at it, and about how Wall Street managed this splendid recovery from a near-death experience to making oodles and oodles of money. How did Wall Street do it? We'll get Matt Taibbi's point of view on that. But some words in the economic news before we get to that. I said last week that the preliminary reports on March shopping showed Americans rediscovering their lust to buy following almost 2 years of born-again prudence. Those early returns, which are based on sales numbers coming from the major chain stores, have now been confirmed by the official word from the Census Bureau, compiler of the monthly retail trade figures. The census stats are based on a much broader survey of the retail universe than just the chain store numbers. The census survey includes not only big national names like Target and Wet Seal, but also local chains, gyms, Main Street, housewares, online retailers, and even museum gift shops. And the Census Bureau tells us that sales rose a strong 1.6% in March from the previous month, or 0.6% if you leave out autos, a pretty strong figure. Autos had a very good month, but so did everything else. Total sales were up 7.6% from a year earlier, or 6.4% excluding autos. This is a very substantial retail recovery. It may not be sustainable, on which more in a sec, but for now, it looks like Americans have had enough of austerity. One reason I wonder how sustainable this is because I can't figure out where the money is coming from. The job market, while picking up, is still quite weak, and it looks like people continued paying off more in their credit cards than they took out in new credits in March. So if it's not from fattening paychecks or bigger Visa balances, where is this little binge getting financed from? Here's one possibility. I post these opening commentaries on a blog, DougHenwood.wordpress.com. That's Doug Henwood, all one word, .wordpress.com. When I asked this question last week, after mulling over the preliminary shopping reports, a reader of the blog offered this comment. Regarding the rebound of consumer spending, from my own experience, I spent most of 2009 worried about getting laid off and subsequently saving every penny I could. After it became clear that I wasn't going to get laid off, I let out a little pent-up demand. I suspect a lot of still-employed people do the same, redirecting some would-be savings toward spending. Could be. The savings rate rose, though not as much as it might have throughout 2009. Let's see if it starts heading south again. And then there are the rich folks. In the chain store survey, published, I should say, by the International Council of Shopping Centers, the purveyors of luxury goods have been clocking higher than average gains since last December. They widened that lead in March. It may be a function both of really rich people opening up their wallets further and the would-be rich now indulging the aspirations they kept on hold through the recession. Further evidence of economic recovery, the National Association of Home Builders' monthly survey of builder sentiment put in a sharp rise in April, exceeding expectations. All of its components, current sales, expected future sales, and foot traffic from in houses, from model houses from prospective buyers, all the components gained. The index is still deep in the basement, and its latest gain just takes it back to where it was last fall, but this is some of the best news coming out of the housing market in ages. We've never had an economic recovery without a housing recovery, so it would be nice if this prerequisite finally fell into place. But not such good news coming out of the job market lately. There's much debate over whether the rather strong gain in employment we saw in March was a fluke or the beginning of a new trend. My guess is that the job market is starting to turn around, but it won't be a smooth or particularly happy path. One disappointing piece of evidence was released on Thursday morning, the weekly jobless claims numbers filed by people who just lost their jobs and signed up for unemployment benefits. Those rose last week by a surprising 24,000, the second consecutive weekly increase. These numbers are volatile. For example, it's not easy to adjust for the effects of the Easter holiday. But even if you take the four-week average, which smooths out the volatility, there was also a second consecutive increase, much smaller in magnitude than the pure weekly numbers. I don't think this is a sign that the labor market is starting to fall apart again, but it is a sign that this won't be an easy road to recovery. And finally, in honor of April 15, a few words on some work by the excellent folks at Citizens for Tax Justice. The Tea Partiers are all in a rage at the alleged, over the alleged tax increases imposed by Obama and the Democrats. And they're not the only ones, since over half of Americans tell pollsters that they think that taxes have gone up over the past year or so. The truth is exactly the opposite. As CTJ points out, the current regime has cut taxes for 98% of working families and individuals by an average of over $1,100. For a change, those in the top 1% are not the biggest beneficiaries either. Fewer than 1 in 3 of that top bracket got any cut at all, and their cut was smaller in dollar terms than the next 19% of the income distribution. The tax cuts were skewed towards the middle and bottom of the income distribution. Why does almost no one know this? Speaking of the Tea Partiers, a couple of polls out this week confirm what we already knew. Tea Party activists, meaning people who've gone to their rallies or donated money to the cause, tend to be whiter, righter, better off, more pious, and more male than the rest of the population. One of the things that set them off most is that they think that Obama is taking their money and giving it to the poor and the black. As we know, he's not. Theirs is a resentment of the privileged, not an expression of working class anger. In other words, they're not the good guys or even reachable by the good guys, as some folks on the left have suggested. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be, I can talk about China. And that is some of Ex-Lion Tamer from Pink Flag, the Wire album from, I believe, 1977. We're hearing some Wire songs throughout this show. The Treasury Department was supposed to issue a report on Thursday, April 15th, on whether China was manipulating its currency or not. China, of course, running giant trade surpluses with the United States, not so big with the rest of the world. And the Treasury has decided to postpone the release of that report for diplomatic reasons. Presumably some arms are being twisted, deals are trying to be cut in private. This is a good time to talk about just what's been going on with the Chinese currency. Are they keeping it artificially low in order to stimulate exports, and is this costing jobs in the United States? And to address those questions, we are now joined by Robert Scott, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute and author of a recent briefing paper on precisely this issue. Welcome to Behind the News, Robert Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the Treasury Department punting on whether to declare China a currency manipulator, but you've made up your mind, haven't you?
Absolutely.
So,
The Treasury, I think, has really been putting on this issue for a long time. This is a pattern of behavior that's been going on through both Democratic and Republican administrations. But the Chinese have been violating every known standard of currency manipulation. They're currently spending about $30 billion a month buying up foreign exchange, trying to keep their currency artificially undervalued, and by the best estimates, it's 40% or more undervalued. This means that what this does, acts as an artificial subsidy to Chinese exports, makes prices of their goods 40% lower than they would be on a fairly priced exchange market, and acts as a tax on U.S. exports, not just to China, but to every country where we compete with China for export sales.
In a lot of cases, if financial markets saw a currency that they thought was deliberately over or undervalued, they would speculate against it and hope that things would break their way. China, although, doesn't really play that game, does it?
No, it doesn't, for two reasons. First of all, China is willing to purchase essentially unlimited quantities of dollars. The amounts they've been buying are simply unprecedented. Last year it was, over $450 billion in total. And secondly, China, unlike most other developed countries, has a closed capital market, so you can't just go in and speculate on the Chinese currency or buy up Chinese assets in the hope that they're going to appreciate. You won't be able to get your money out if you do.
And what has the impact been on the U.S. in your estimation?
Well, my study shows that in the last 7 years, between 2007 and 2000, I'm sorry, between 2001 and 2008, the growth in the U.S. trade deficit with China has displaced about 2.4 million jobs. Now, those weren't all lost due to growing currency manipulation. I think other factors have contributed, including things like suppression of labor rights.
Now, the U.S. is no slouch at that either. We should
no,
be
no.
Fair to
By
say.
The way, we don't. We are not. We have not endorsed all the core labor standards recognized by the International Labor Organization. So we don't have a lot to complain about there. But nonetheless, it's much worse than China, as you know. China also has massive subsidies of all kinds of products, and it has extensive barriers, both tariff and non-tariff barriers, to imports. So in every way that it can violate fair trade standards, China is doing everything it can to stimulate its exports and to limit imports.
China's a member of the World Trade Organization. Why don't they suffer any kind of sanction under the WTO's rules?
Well, frankly, the WTO is, to a great extent, a toothless tiger. It costs tens of millions of dollars to bring a single WTO case. They take years to pursue. The U.S. has pursued several in the last 2 or 3 years. But even in those few cases, we're really proceeding bit by bit to take on the Chinese violations on issues like intellectual property rights. We might earn a few billion dollars more if we get to China to pay more for our records and tapes. But that's not going to really make a dent in this trade deficit that's been growing at $30 to $40 billion every year, year in and year out.
Give us some more detail on your estimation of the job losses in the United States. But these are pretty big numbers. How are they distributed?
Well, I looked at it both by industry and also then in terms of by region. Surprisingly, we're not just importing shoes and textiles from China anymore. China has moved rapidly up the technology scale, and about 40% of the growth in the trade deficit that I talked about was made up of growth of imports of computer electronic products. So that was responsible for about a quarter of all the jobs displaced, about 630,000 jobs lost between 2001 and 2008. We also have a huge deficit in overall high-tech products, including things like the biotech products, which includes all kinds of unsafe drugs imported from China. So China is not just to take away jobs in low-tech industries, but in high-tech industries as well. And you see that reflected in the kinds of information that exists on how these job losses are distributed geographically. I've estimated the job losses due to growing China trade deficits both by state and also by congressional district. Now, I know that your listeners are in, I think, New York and California now, is that right,
yes,
Doug?
Yes, both places, yeah. Yes.
And both came out high on my list. In terms of the numbers of jobs lost, the absolute numbers of jobs lost, California came in number one at, I think, the figure was about 300,000 jobs were displaced in California, and it was 370,000 jobs displaced in California. That was 2.25% of all the people employed in the most recent period. New York was also high on the list, as about 140,500 jobs displaced, over 1.5% of total employment in California in the period 2005-2007. That's just a base period I used to calculate these percentages. Go ahead.
Oh, no, and what about industry distribution?
Well, in terms of industry distribution, as I mentioned, one of the hardest hit was the computer electronic products. They lost about 600,000 jobs. Some of the other big losers included sectors in the durable goods industry. So those were hard hit, and such as machine tools and other electronic products as well. And then we also saw, in terms of breaking it down in terms of job-by-job basis, electrical equipment, we lost 64,000 jobs. In fabricated metal products, we lost 109,000 jobs. We also lost a number of jobs in industries that support manufacturing. Manufacturing overall absorbed about two-thirds of the job loss, about 1.6 million. But we also lost jobs in, for example, professional, scientific, and technical services. We lost about 140,000 jobs in that sector. In administration and support, we lost about 160,000 jobs. In finance, insurance, and real estate, we lost about 50,000, and so on. So this is I think the impacts were felt broadly on an industry-by-industry basis.
I was surprised looking at the list by the large number of job losses in durable goods manufacturing. That generally involves more skilled labor, higher up the value chain, as they say in the business jargon, not real low-end manufacturing, you know, like rubber gloves or you know, stuff like that, but
right.
More complicated stuff with higher wage jobs. So they're really moving up the ladder.
Very fast, very fast. I mean, we certainly still, there were a number of jobs displaced in footwear, apparel, the traditional industries, but those were actually the minority of the jobs lost, even within manufacturing, probably less than 200,000 in apparel, less than 100,000 each, I think, in leather and allied products, textiles, and so on. So those are the non-durable goods. The low-tech stuff is actually the least important part of China's exports. They're really moving into more sophisticated durable goods in a big way.
I'm speaking with Robert Scott, who is a staff economist with the Economic Policy Institute and author of Unfair China Trade, Cost Local Jobs, a EPI briefing paper that came out a couple of weeks ago. Is it EPI.net or EPI.org now?
EPI.org.
Yes, EPI.org, if you want to get a copy of this paper. The Council on Foreign Relations had a brief note up today on their website saying that one study by a think tank, I can't recall which one, said that Chinese manufacturers could actually make more money by letting the value of the currency rise. That would lower the cost of imported goods, machinery, and raw materials, but it would result in job losses. And the Chinese government is actually more interested in preserving jobs than they are concerned about the profits of their manufacturers. They're concerned about social stability if the value of the currency rises and their imports, the employment takes a hit as a result of that. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think we've seen that reflected in China in recent days. There have been news reports that Chinese manufacturers have actually come out publicly and called for currency appreciation. It's really quite shocking. But the currency appreciation would help China in several ways. It would help reduce inflationary pressure. The price of imports came down. It would compete and keep the prices lower in China. It would also raise the purchasing power of workers in China, and of course that's going to be a special benefit to those who already have a lot of money, that is the owners of those Chinese companies. So they would benefit greatly from cheaper imports. On the other hand, I think that, as you mentioned, that the Chinese government is very, very nervous about its political position, and I think they have the fifth year with Chinese Congress coming up in a couple of years, and they're very nervous about a political unrest building up over the next year or two that could destabilize the political situation, make it difficult for the party to continue its control of this of society in the way it has for the last 50 or so years. So I think it's a very real concern, and I think it's mistaken. I think China, you know, there's a limit to China's ability to continue to grow simply by shipping abroad ever larger quantities of exports. I think they need to grow to develop a different kind of a development model that's going to be based more on meeting the needs of its own huge domestic population.
But should we be concerned from an international labor solidarity viewpoint about advocating a policy that would possibly preserve or expand American jobs at the expense of Chinese workers?
Well, I don't think it's just American jobs that are at stake. China has actually exported unemployment. Paul Krugman, event we had a few weeks ago, estimated that China had reduced world GDP by about 1.5 points. So China is really exporting its unemployment everywhere in the world. It's practicing a beggar-thy-neighbor policy. And these policies amount to protectionism on China's part. So is it fair to allow China to continue to practice protectionism and take away jobs from workers in places like Vietnam and Bangladesh as well as the United States? I don't think so. I think China needs to adopt a growth strategy that is more sustainable, both for China as well as the rest of the world.
Now, if the value of the Chinese currency were to appreciate, how much would that benefit U.S. workers, and how much would that be to the advantage of other low-wage producers, you named some, but also Mexico? Mexico tried to build an electronics industry just as China was coming on the scene, and it got crushed. But would Mexico, Vietnam take the place of Chinese exports and not we wouldn't see the repatriation of American manufacturing jobs?
I think we'd see a little bit of both. And I think we have to look at it from a global perspective. There are going to be two things that are going to go on here. China is not the only currency manipulator. There are a number of other countries in Asia, particularly Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia. All of them are also manipulating their currencies by anywhere from 25 to 32%. They need to revalue as well. They need to raise the value of their currencies, stop manipulating. Japan has a currency that's still probably 10 or 15% undervalued. They've been playing this game for longer than anybody. So I think what we need to see is a general global realignment of currencies, and what that will do is open up space, open up demand for exports from countries around the world. Hopefully some of those will go to Asia. They should be the biggest market for these commodities, and that will help rebuild manufacturing production in the U.S. and in other countries. What I'd like to see happen is the U.S. share of world manufactured markets would begin to rise again. It's been falling for about 10 or 12 years now. It's fallen sharply, unlike some other countries like Germany. Germany's had a stable share of world manufacturing production for the last dozen years. The U.S. has lost almost a third of its share of world markets.
Yeah, it does seem like the U.S. has been hit much harder by Chinese competition than like other countries like Germany. Europe doesn't have quite the same problem with China that we do, does it?
Well, it does have a problem. They do have growing trade deficits with China as well. And that's the somewhat surprising thing about this currency conundrum, is that the Europeans have not been there with us. It is in their interest just as much as it is ours to get the Chinese to revalue. So they do have much to gain. But, yes, you're right. They in general, have more balanced trade. Germany has maintained, in particular, trade surpluses throughout the past decade. I think the countries in Europe that have felt the brunt of it have actually been the ones in the south, Greece and Italy and Spain, Portugal. Those countries all run trade deficits. And I think they're ones that are finding it particularly difficult to compete with extremely low-wage labor and unfairly priced imports from China.
Now, I just have a question about the methodology of your work. Translating this into radio, radio-friendly, simple terms, it seems that what you do is look at the imports in a particular industry and say that these imports translate into so many job losses. And what it seems, what you don't do, as far as I can tell, is look at any possible gains from trade. For example, if I save money on buying a TV, I can spend that money on eating out or getting my hair cut more often. Are there any compensating gains from trade that your analysis doesn't take into account?
Well, I think you can make that argument, and some have made it. My colleague Josh Bivens goes through this the broader, what you might call a pardon the term, general equilibrium question. That's what you're really asking in econo-speak. It's the, you know, the overall costs and benefits of trade with a country like China. I look at the narrow cost and benefits, both the jobs displaced by imports and the job gains by gained by exports. So at least at that level, I'm looking at both sides of the score, as it were, and we lose big in that in that contest. We import five times as much from China as we export to them, and so the jobs are distributed accordingly. The benefits in part of this trade we've had with China has been that we have had a flood of savings coming into this country over the past decade. So we got cheap capital. All the money that China invested in low-yielding treasury bills kept interest rates low here in the United States. And we have to ask, what did that allow us to do? It allowed us to develop the biggest property and investment bubble that we've seen in probably a century or more in this country. So it did keep the economy afloat in the first decade of this century, but at a tremendous price. I think that price has been that we've developed this very unbalanced economy. We had too much investment in housing, too little investment in manufacturing. So on balance, I don't think we've gained that much from trade, even looking at the broader costs and benefits.
We've only got about 45 seconds left, but I do want to ask this question. When we say China, we're actually in part talking about American companies that import things from China, whether it's Walmart directly or Apple contracting to have iPods manufactured in China. When we say China, it's not necessarily a purely Chinese strategy that we're talking about.
Absolutely not. And I think it's key to remember that U.S. multinationals are working in league with the Chinese government on this issue. It is going to hurt multinational companies in the U.S., but what needs to change is we need to develop policies that are in the interest of the U.S. as a place where we produce goods and services, not just worry about the interests of our companies, which is what we've been doing for far too long.
All right, thank you. I've been speaking with Robert Scott, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute and author of an EPI briefing paper, Unfair China Trade Costs Local Jobs, which you can get from their website at epi.org. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about Wall Street.
Hi, my name is Letty. When I'm in New York, I always have my radio tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. And when I'm back home in France, I listen on the web at wbai.org.
Salut, je m'appelle Laetitia, et quand je suis à New York, j'écoute WBAI sur 99.5 FM. Et quand je rentre en France, j'écoute WBAI sur Internet à wbai.org.
And we're back here. This is WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, be sure to hit that donate button to swell our cash flow, which we can always use. Okay. Let's take a musical break, and I'll be back with Matt Taibbi. We'll be right back. And that's some of Ambitious from Wire, the second Wire song we've heard in the show. We'll hear one going out as well. And that's from their 1987 album, The Ideal Copy. Now, interview recorded earlier today with Matt Taibbi, the Rolling Stone writer, also writer for True Slant, and who's been the scourge of Wall Street over the last couple of years, investigating how they got into this mess, what they've been doing, how they got everyone else into a deep mess, and how they've been making money, not only off the mess, but the bailout of the mess. Let's hear from Matt Taibbi. Okay, welcome, Matt. Let's start with how Wall Street has been making money by taking advantage of perhaps a naivete of some folks in the red states. You've got a story in the recent Rolling Stone about Birmingham, Alabama, which needed a new sewer system. First of all, tell us why Birmingham needed a new sewer system.
Well, they had an ancient system that was completely discombobulated. It was a number of different municipal sewer systems sort of, you know, lumped into one. In the mid-80s, it started leaking into the Cahaba River, which was a source of water for the people in the area. So a local environmental group, in conjunction with the EPA, filed a lawsuit against the county and forced them to build a new sewer system. And what's interesting about this is that the county fought against the lawsuit tooth and nail, but as soon as it became clear that they were going to lose, their attitude completely changed, and suddenly they were embracing the biggest, most expensive sewer system you can possibly imagine. The subplot being there that they suddenly realized that they were going to be able to funnel lots and lots of money to all their buddies in the contracting community. So that's how that happened.
So it went from a few $100 million to the billions, right?
Yeah, the initial cost estimate for this sewer system was $250 million. In very short order, the actual cost turned out to be $3 billion, and that had to do with some peculiarities of local politics down there. They didn't have to actually submit cost estimates. They could just build it and then bill later, and that's kind of how this thing blew up to to such exponential amounts. And then, of course, what happened was when it came time to pay for this gigantic Taj Mahal of sewage treatment plants, that's when they got in trouble. That's when they went to Wall Street and did these refinance deals that were completely predatory and ended up getting the county in trouble for a generation.
What was the local sewer authority was on the hook for the whole amount?
Well, the county was on the hook for the whole amount. It's they borrowed $3 billion. The county commissioners had a law that basically mandated that they had to raise sewer prices automatically in order to pay off any debt service on what they borrowed. So that would have been politically unpopular. They were looking at price increases. So what they did is they went to Wall Street and they said, what can we do to keep our debt payments low? And this is where Wall Street came in and said, well, we can do these interest rate swaps for you that will refinance your debt and kick it down the road, 4 years, 8 years, so that the next group of politicians has to deal with it. And that's where they got in all the trouble.
So they didn't just go float some straight municipal bonds. They got fancy.
They got fancy. They originally had the very simple, 30-year fixed municipal bonds. And this is very analogous to the mortgage situation. It used to be that, everybody did these 30-year fixed mortgages. The problem with those is that from the business end, they don't make very big fees for the lenders. So there became this incredible incentive in the financial community to try to sell people on variable rate loans of any kind, mortgages, variable rate mortgages, and in this case, variable rate municipal bonds or auction rate bonds. These are much riskier, but they promise lower payments initially. If you team those up with something called interest rate swaps, that's how communities get into real trouble, because what they're doing is they're getting riskier debt, and then they're using this very fancy device called an interest rate swap to artificially reduce their payments for a while.
The municipal bond business on the face of it is a pretty sleepy thing, very stodgy, old-fashioned, but actually Wall Street makes some money on that through a lot of exchange of money and personal connections. Tell us a little bit about how the municipal bond business works.
Well, again, the municipal bond business used to be a very straightforward, boring, staid kind of business where the profit margins were very small. You know, you'd go to these municipalities, you'd get them a 30-year fixed-rate deal, and Wall Street wasn't making a whole lot of money doing it. When they started inventing fancier ways to do this debt, which included variable rate bonds, auction rate bonds, and then these interest rate swaps, suddenly Wall Street found out that there could be, you know, great fortunes to be made, you know, selling these kinds of instruments to these towns and states. So what the typical scenario is, you know, a big bank will go to this municipality and it will identify some local joker who's close to the politician making the decisions. They will funnel a ton of money to this guy. They'll take him to the Super Bowl. They'll take him to strip clubs. And that guy will, in turn, funnel all that largesse to the politician who signs off on the crappy deals, which blow up 10 years later, long after the politician has left the scene. And this is the template for what has gone on all across the country, and that's what happened in Jefferson County.
All right, so fill in the blanks with the Birmingham scene.
The Birmingham scene, it's pretty much exactly what I just said. Birmingham was in trouble. It was facing, you know, rising debt payments. They had a new county commissioner come in the early part of last decade named Larry Lankford. Lankford, after he got elected, he kind of put the word out that anybody who wanted to do business with Jefferson County had to go see a buddy of his named Bill Blount, who was a local investment banker. And so every one of the major investment banks on Wall Street, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, they all descended upon this Bill Blount character and started offering him stuff. Initially, Blount went with Goldman Sachs, but J.P. Morgan wanted so badly to do these deals that they ended up doing a separate deal with Goldman Sachs where they paid him, where they paid Goldman $3 million to back out of the deal so that they could go in and fleece Jefferson County all by themselves, and that's kind of what happened in that scenario.
And so this local guy, like Blount, for example, in this case, he just provides some sort of connections for the local scene, for the strangers on Wall Street to take advantage of. That's the service he provides, right? He's not really banking in any conventional sense.
That's the only service that he provides, and he does absolutely no legitimate work. And in this case, Blount made almost $8 million in fees from all these different banks. And at no point did he provide any expertise whatsoever or any real work. His entire job was convincing the local politician to go with this or that bank.
And, of course, J.P. Morgan not only was aware of this, I mean, they cultivated these kinds of relationships, right?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that's interesting about Jefferson County is that we have this amazing telephone record of this entire scandal. You know, Jefferson County kind of, in Nixonian fashion, was taping all the phone calls of its employees, so we can see what they were thinking throughout this entire episode. And there's all this great stuff where, you know, a J.P. Morgan banker named Charles LaCroix is talking about, you know, what it was going to take financially to get Lankford and Blount to sign off on the deal. And they have, you know, this one excerpt where LaCroix is saying, oh, yeah, I talked to the commissioner and I said, you know, just tell us how much it's going to take. You got to get your guy Blount in line because you give this guy a hand, he takes an arm. I mean, they're just talking openly about bribery. There's no question at all that they knew exactly what this was all about. They called it the cost of doing business in these tapes.
And so they just piled interest rate swap on interest rate swap. It just got more complex with each successive transaction.
That's right. And, you know, again, this is a process that they call churning. You know, people might be familiar with this with the mortgage business. You come to somebody and you offer them a variable rate mortgage, which is going to have an initially low rate. The person says to you, well, what happens in a couple of years when interest rates go up? And you say, don't worry about that. If that happens, you just come back to me and we'll refinance into a new mortgage and everything is going to be cool. Well, every time you refinance, you do that refinancing, the lender makes fees. And that's called churning in this business. You take the same borrower and you just churn them for fees over and over again. And that's what happened in Jefferson County. These guys, they did 23 swap deals with Jefferson County. And every time they did this, they made tens of millions of dollars in fees. And what's interesting about that is that the money that they spent on these local, you know, middlemen, these guys who were doing the bribes, they actually figured that money into the cost of these swaps. So not only were they bribing the local politicians, they got the taxpayers to pay for the bribes. It's really kind of an amazing thing.
Now, here you're saying bribing without a wussy allegedly inserted. So there, this has actually been criminally decided?
Oh, yeah. The county commissioner, Larry Langford, he's already been sentenced to 15 years. Blount got 4 years. There was another guy named Al LaPierre, who was another sort of middleman. He got a criminal sentence. Now, J.P. Morgan has not been criminally prosecuted for any of this, but they have been sanctioned and censured by the SEC, and from what I understand, the investigation is ongoing, but it's certainly not inaccurate to describe what happened as bribery. That was what Langford and Blount went to jail for.
But the charm for the Wall Street guys, they seem to lead charm lives. They don't have to worry about criminal sanctions for what is plainly being the other side of a bribery transaction.
Well, again, this is just sort of a consistent theme of the financial crisis, that these guys never, ever go to jail. The way it always happens is there's a quote-unquote global settlement where, you know, some state or, you know, municipal authority will haul in the guilty party, the bank, and they will have a financial settlement that almost always includes a passage that says that there's no admission of wrongdoing. And then the bank gets away with a fine and just moves on to the next scam. That's kind of what happened here in Jefferson County. That's what happened up in Massachusetts with Goldman Sachs and their mortgage fiasco. It happened when Elliot Spitzer took on the banks for all the stuff that they did during the internet bubble period. That was another global settlement. This stuff just goes on and on and on, and it's always the same thing. They have to pay a little bit of money and they move on.
Your piece is about Birmingham. We've been talking mostly about Birmingham, but how many Birminghams were there around the United States, actually around the world?
They're all over the place. In the United States, you can find swap deals going south in almost any state. You know, a great example is this Pennsylvania school system. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, got hit with a very similar situation to Jefferson County where they suddenly had a swap deal terminated. And they owe J.P. Morgan $13 million. The city of Chicago, Los Angeles, Oakland, Philadelphia, actually Charles LaCroix, that same J.P. Morgan banker, he actually did get convicted for something that went on in Philadelphia that was similar. And then, of course, you know, you have Greece, you have Milan, Italy. There are hundreds of communities across Europe that are having the same kinds of problems with swap deals. It may be more obscene and more cartoonish in Jefferson County, but it's basically the same idea.
How much of this is a case of Wall Street Sharpies ripping off locals, and how much is it a case of the locals should have known better or were actually actively complicit in what was going on?
Oh, there's no question that these guys, the local officials, are actively complicit in what's going on. The only the difference with this stuff is it's always an open question how much the locals really understand the finances of what they're getting into. I mean, one thing that we know for sure about Jefferson County is that even though these guys, like Langford, these local politicians, signed off on these swap deals that they may have known were not good deals, they were probably not aware that they were being overcharged for the swap deals. In addition to them being toxic and predatory and dangerous, a local investment firm that later analyzed the deals found that they were overcharged by about $90 million. Now, that's just the nature of this market. The derivatives market is done almost entirely in the dark. Nobody really has, there's no transparency about interest rate swaps, and nobody knows what they cost. And so what tends to happen is that these local officials, even if they do understand the nature of what they're getting into, they have a very poor understanding of the actual cost of these transactions, and that's where they get into a lot of trouble.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, reporter for Rolling Stone. Okay, let's switch topics a little bit. It is now earnings season. Some of the big Wall Street banks are about to report their profits for the first quarter. And there's some talk that they're having rough comparisons with last year because last year was so good. Now, the fact that last year was so good is a story in itself. So let's talk a bit about why Wall Street recovered so quickly from what seemed to be a near-death experience.
Well, I mean, that's not a mystery at all why Wall Street did well last year. They were showered with, you know, trillions of dollars of government money, which made it virtually impossible for all these banks to fail. And again, this was a conscious strategy by the government to recapitalize these banks. What they did, there were lots and lots of different programs that were used. But the big one was basically slashing interest rates to almost nothing, giving these banks access to basically free money. Now, if you're a bank, that's what your business is. It's all about cost of capital. If you can get your money for free and you're lending it out to you and me for, 10%, 15%, or however much consumer credit costs, 20%, 25%, how do you not make money in that circumstance? And that's what happened. I mean, these guys basically got to borrow tons of money for free and get well again. And so the spigot is turning off a little bit now, and that's why, things are slowing down a little bit. But that was the thing that went on last year.
They're supposed to be getting this money because they're supposed to then lend it to consumers and businesses. Did they do any of that? Or what did they do with the money that they got?
No, not at all. There was sort of a staring contest that went on between Wall Street and the government at the very beginning. At around this time last year, the banks were getting well again, and what they were doing instead of lending was allotting themselves gigantic bonuses. Goldman Sachs was the great example. They suddenly turned a massive profit number in the first quarter, and they set aside billions of dollars in bonuses and compensation rather than lend the money out in the economy. And as a result of that, what the government was forced to do is create this program called quantitative easing, which is just a fancy way of saying that they printed about $1.7 billion worth of money.
Trillion dollars worth of money, right?
And they just used that money to buy mortgages and buy treasury bonds. And this is all complicated, but essentially the government printed money to create a market for the stuff that the banks were holding. So they became the customers of these banks. In addition to giving them free money, they also provided a market for them, and that's what ended up happening.
And when you say they took the money about treasury bonds, what you're really saying is that the government gave them free money and then the banks lent it back to the government at 3 or 4% interest.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. You have this quantitative easing program. You funnel money into the economy. Great example, you have some of these bond funds would sell a whole bunch of mortgages to the government, take the proceeds of that, buy treasury bonds from the government, and then lend the money back, which amounts to basically lending back the money to the government at 3 or 4%. So again, you're getting money at zero, you're lending it back to the government at 4%, and that's just free money. I mean, you don't even have to move to make that money. And if you do that on a big enough scale, well, you're talking about billions of dollars in profits.
Now, you could argue, I would argue, that the government had to do something to prevent the financial system from imploding or all be wearing barrels, but there was no scrutiny of anything, no conditions attached to the money that went out the door, was there?
No, there were a few conditions attached to some of the programs. I mean, one of the most notable being the TARP. There were some compensation restrictions that were attached to that, relatively small slice of the bailout. But other than that, no. I mean, you could take this money and you could do whatever you wanted with it. You could turn it into, compensation and bonuses, which again, that's what Goldman Sachs did. They got all this free money, and what did they do with it? They had, a $16.5 billion bonus pool last year. Total, the top five banks on Wall Street had over $140 billion in bonuses last year. And it's almost entirely state money, and that's what they did with it.
Can we assume that Tim Geithner knew what he's doing, or is he Larry Lankford on a very large scale? How do we explain the government's just handing over enormous amounts of money without any strings attached to it?
Because, I think Tim Geithner, I believe, is an example of somebody who really believes in this sort of Ayn Randian trickle-down mindset. I think these guys, some people want to paint them as sort of Hamburglar-style, cartoon villains who are just out there to enrich their buddies, which on some level is true, but I also think that they genuinely believe that what's good for Goldman Sachs and for J.P. Morgan Chase is good for the country, and I think they really thought that the way out for all of us was to get these guys well again, but they're so far out of touch with the rest of the country that they don't understand that if you funnel what little money we have to enact a bailout strictly to these few actors and leave everybody else hanging, what you're going to get is a situation where we have right now, where the stock market is going up, but it's basically a jobless recovery. And I think these guys are just blind to the reality of that situation.
And then finally, let's just talk a little bit about the AIG bailout, which is one of the stinkiest things in the whole financial rescue package as well.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of worry about AIG went under, everything else would go with them. But who ended up with all the money, that over $100 billion that went into AIG?
Well, the biggest AIG bailout wasn't really a bailout of AIG. It was a bailout of AIG's counterparties, who were mostly banks like Goldman, like banks of Société Générale, like Deutsche Bank. You know, these are people. You have to remember that AIG during the housing crisis was kind of like the big sucker at the poker table. When people wanted to bet against the housing market, you know, there were a few canny actors out there who understood that the housing bubble was going to blow up. The way they bet against the housing bubble was they bought credit default insurance on housing securities, and they did that with AIG. They basically bought insurance policies against the house they thought was going to burn down. And they did this by going to AIG. So when the housing bubble burst, all of these actors stood to make an enormous amount of money on the bets that they made. But if AIG went under, they were not going to be able to collect on that money. So they had to get a bailout in order to get that money back. And so all those billions of dollars that we gave to AIG, basically that went to people who bet against the housing market and wanted to collect on those bets.
So here we are, you know, what is it, a year and a half after Lehman went under, and people are starting to sound the all clear. Some of the junky securities that looked like they were going to go into default have been rallying like crazy. Stock market's doing pretty well. Should we breathe a sigh of relief, or should we be worried about the next one?
We should definitely be worried about the next one. One of the things you have to remember about all the good news emanating from the financial services industry is that, you know, right after the financial crisis, we eliminated mark-to-market accounting. And what that basically meant was that, you know, all of these assets that the banks were holding on their balance sheets, we're giving them credit for full value on a lot of those assets when they might actually be only be worth 5 or 10 cents in the dollar. It's widely understood on Wall Street that if we actually went in and marked all the assets that were on the balance sheets of all these financial companies, all of them would be at best insolvent and at worst, you know, billions and billions of dollars in debt. The reason that they're all looking healthy right now is because we're allowing them to cover up their losses. So at some point, the dam is going to break. It's like Lehman Brothers used their financial wizardry for as long as possible to save off the end, and that's what all these guys are doing right now, and eventually it's probably going to burst somewhere.
And finally, you know, we're always hearing that the reason that Wall Street has to pay these giant salaries is that they need to retain the skilled staff. And of course, you know, Lloyd Lightfine and all these characters are saying that these enormous pay packets are commensurate with the skills that they demonstrate, they embody. You've been immersed in covering this world now for a couple of years. What have you determined these skills to be?
Well, if you talk to anybody who doesn't work for Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase, I mean, it'll be hard for them to stop laughing when you raise that kind of point. Most of these companies, they make their money basically because they have an advantageous market position that allows them to read the market better than everybody else. If you're Goldman Sachs and you know you've got a billion-dollar client order from the California Pension Fund that you're going to be putting into the market later that day, well, it's not that hard to make a whole lot of money trading ahead of that order. The biggest companies have more access to information than everybody else. They're getting free money from the government. They're getting all this protection. They have an implicit guarantee as well. I mean, that's another thing about the bailouts that people don't realize. When the whole world recognizes that the government is never ever going to let you go under, that makes your cost of borrowing plummet to almost nothing. Now, who wouldn't lend money to Goldman Sachs? You know, you're always going to get paid off. So these guys have nothing but advantages. It's almost impossible for them to not make money. And so for them to say, oh, well, we deserve this because we're so good at what we do, well, you know, it's comical. It's comical especially because they almost destroyed the world a couple of years ago. And here we are, our strategy is to just go back and give them money to start it all over again. So I'm very skeptical of that claim.
And since you're in Vegas, I think it's appropriate to say basically they're the house, except they're the house at the center of the economy and not just a little theme park where middle-class people go off and play at Vicey games for a weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, not. That's exactly the situation. The house never loses. And, you know, if you're in the middle of the commodities market, if you're Goldman Sachs and you run the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, you know, every time people bet on oil prices, Goldman gets a cut. It's the same thing as, you know, if I went downstairs in my hotel right now and, you know, I've been on the roulette wheel all day long, well, the house is going to get some of my money no matter what happens. And that's exactly how these guys operate.
I've been speaking with Matt Taibbi, who's a regular contributor to Rolling Stone and the True Slant website. Matt's one of those rare writers who both knows what he's talking about and can uncork a great and hilarious polemic. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a third song from the splendid 30-year-old band Wire. This from their 2008 release, Object 47. The song is One of Us. Till next week, bye.